Hey guys, I'm super excited before you listen to the podcast to announce a new initiative on Twitter, Gary VEE TV. Is that right, Jim? There it is. Gary VEE TV. Go follow it. Unlimited quality clips daily on Twitter. Something I'm testing out that I think you guys are gonna love and enjoy. If you are looking for more content and more context and more information, go to Twitter and check up and look up Gary VEE TV, my new account. Check me out. Hope you enjoy it and hit me up on Twitter and let me know how you like it. Thanks, guys.
This is the Gary V Audio Experience.
Thank you for joining us on Coffee and Commerce. I don't know if this is an insult or a compliment, but before I introduce my tremendous guest, one of the gentlemen I most admire in the last 30 years of e-commerce, I've been getting enormous amounts of feedback from the first two episodes of this show. And a lot of people have basically been saying things like, yeah, I really haven't liked anything he's put out for 7 years, but this is actually decent. So like, it's been really fun. Great feedback. It's been quite practical. It's a subject matter that I'm very comfortable with, that I don't speak a lot about. And obviously, if you're just joining us, the announcement of Vayner Commerce, the new VaynerX company, it has inspired this content series, a little limited run that, you know, now I'm starting to wonder if it should have some more legs to it. Toby, thank you so much for joining us. For everybody who's listening and watching, can you please tell everybody who you are and what you do, and then we'll get into a couple of subject matters. I really appreciate your time. I know you're super busy and it's a challenging time for a lot of different people in different ways, but a publicly traded CEO's got a lot on his plate. So I really genuinely appreciate it. Plus, you look extremely stylish. The jean jacket is legit, bro. So I'm happy you're here.
Thank you. Thank you, Gary. Thanks for giving me an opportunity to break your run of two really great pieces of content.
Get out of here.
Because this is all going downhill this episode.
I doubt that.
I'm Toby Lütke. I founded Shopify to...
Go ahead.
What's this? Okay. Sorry, I'm getting an echo from somewhere.
Do you have it running? Do you have it potentially running in the background somewhere?
Probably.
Yes, I think so. Maybe a Facebook or something.
Sorry about that. Cool. Name is Toby Lütke. I founded Shopify 15, 16 years ago now. I have a pleasure to be on a journey with amazing people, trying to build a company that I wish would have existed back in those days. And I hope it's the kind of company that everyone is happy that exists, because we are trying to make it much, much easier for entrepreneurs on the internet, building businesses and scaling them to be meaningful contributions to global network of commerce.
So Toby, take me, before we get into the Shopify origin story, how about you yourself? Like, where were you born? What kind of kid were you?
I was born in Germany, Koblenz, Germany, sort of city of 80,000 people. Very nerdy kid, did not like school did not like me, but had the great fortune of growing up in the 80s and 90s, where computing was very new as sort of one of the earliest cohorts of what you could describe as digitally native people. Spent a lot of my teens programming. I apprenticed after school as a computer programmer for Siemens. Learned that particular trade.
Oh, so like, yes. A real big, I'm trying to paint some pictures for everybody who's listening. Siemens is a real company. So a kid, so you were clearly a very talented programmer.
No, the apprentice system, I mean, I hope I was, but school didn't give the indication that I would be very talented at
me
much.
Neither,
I didn't get the marks for that. But then Germany has a wonderful apprentice system, which allows you to join a company such as Siemens. Now, you're quite right. That's a serious company. You do not wear jean jackets anywhere.
No.
But it was a great experience. I learned how to sort of professionalize my hobby of computer programming. Took that with me, and then a couple of years later, I ended up in Canada, who is my girlfriend and now wife is from, and I needed some kind of way to sustain myself. So in 2004, I decided to start an online business, because I always loved retail. I was always a kid who I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about school, but I did get whatever the kids were into somehow at wholesale, and then sold it to my classmates and made a profit and used it to buy like whatever I needed.
Toby, for everybody who's listening, entrepreneurship, and I can speak for America, you can speak for Germany, like, you know, when I hear that, that's so cliche of what I talk about all the time. Show me the kid that bought blow pops and sold them in school, yo-yos, baseball cards, to your point, Pokemon, whatever was cool. But I don't remember people using the word entrepreneur when I was a kid. I remember thinking, and I was very proud of this part of my life. I also spent zero on school and everything on this. And I thought I was a businessman. Like that's what I thought. Was it frowned upon that you were doing that? Was it heralded? Did you have a grandfather or uncle or teacher that was like, keep doing it? Or what was your dynamic?
Yeah, I had a, my role model was my grandma, who had this like, I keep forgetting what this is called in English. It's like a print shop, basically, like big old letterpress machines and so on. Mm. She started that like right after World War II, and first woman to do any such thing, and build it up and made it a meaningful business. And I loved spending my time there during youth. And like I talked with her about, hey, you know, how is this, like, how does that all transpire? And she just said, you know, like, I need to kind of do my own thing. And that seems like the kind of thing I would want too. And I wouldn't have never called it entrepreneurship either. In fact, I remember when my wife, like, I remember hearing that term, like, years after starting Shopify and for the first time and had to ask someone what that means. So I don't think
I remember the first time I saw Entrepreneurship magazine in the airport. I was deep into Wine Library and winelibrary.com at that point. And I was like, you know, my original thoughts of the word entrepreneur in the 90s was a kid that's actually not doing it. And like they would put on a business card, entrepreneur, which meant you were bullshitting with your parents' money or just laying on the beach. Like it felt almost not like you were doing something. And in a lot of ways, I think the popularity of entrepreneurship that you and I have seen transpire over the last 15 years, I think we both probably can agree. This is why I've always loved Shopify. And obviously, you know, Harley and I have a very close relationship, and I've always leaned into our relationship. I've done a lot of stuff with you and for you in the past. It's because I always thought it was a practical business. You know, the practical nature that, and I'll be honest with you, Toby, one thing that we don't get to talk a lot. I'm glad I get to use this medium to say this. I also really admire the fact that you're passionate about company culture in the way that I am. And I've always really admired that from afar. And I try to do it through words and content. You do it through tools. I think you're arming entrepreneurs at a level that is staggering. It's why I've always loved Matt Mullenweg as well. As a matter of fact, the first time I met you, I remember leaving and saying, man, if I was a good nerd and I could code, I'd be one of those guys, because they've built tools that arm the spirit of scale for people like me, WordPress on the content side. Anthony too, from Squarespace. Like there's a similarity. Literally, I was missing the programming gene, but had I had it, I genuinely believe I could have stumbled my way into a very similar world. Obviously, a lot of people have gone in that world. You've built one of the most significant, scalable, sustainable businesses in it. But I just really admire a lot of those things from Shopify and you, Toby.
Thank you so much. I think all three of the people you named there, like we are all fairly similar in the way that we all discovered programming fairly early. Like, I mean, so much of a life journey is like find the gift that you might have, then spend time developing it. And once you've done that, you hopefully give it away and share it with people. And like Squarespace, WordPress, and Shopify, I think are all fairly pure manifestations of this idea of like finding something, developing it, and then sharing it. So I think it's an incredibly meaningful thing to get to do. And I come as incredibly lucky that I've come across something like this.
Let's get back. So 2004, you start an e-commerce business. You've got that merchant DNA in you. And what kind of business is it?
So I thought snowboard. Only reason is because I was snowboarding a lot, and so I was deep into the research of what is a good snowboard, and I needed something to sell, and it seemed like a good idea. So I that's what I did. And
and how'd it go?
I had to go at it. Had to build the software myself. That was my surprise, but ended up being a very fateful insight because I just realized, no, like, even though there was some e-commerce software back then, that was all done for people who already had a lot of money and had like e-com specialists, and like nothing was built for entrepreneurs. And that seemed meaningful. And
I remember, I 90% of my energy in building winelibrary.com from 1997 till 2002, 90% of my energy was building the site and keeping it up. I was such a good marketer that I was able to get attention for the website greater than my, Toby, this is real. This is insane what I'm about to say. Wine Library, which was a tiny business at the time when I hired them, we went from 4 to 10 million overnight the first year I ran it, as a $10 million business doing 10% gross profit, no money, $1 million in profit before expenses, no money. I hired 2 full-time developers. I didn't even know what a developer was. They were working for some outsourced company that built my website. And I was like, can I steal you guys? They were like in Jersey. They're like, yeah, I literally just texted with one of them, John Casamatis. We're working on, we just switched over our wine text platform and something's not working. I'm literally texting with one. Another is one of my dearest friends, Eric Kastner. But could you imagine a single store liquor store in New Jersey having to hire 2 full-time developers? And the only reason I could afford them was the internet bubble happened in 2000, right? And all these developers were just available to be hired. But that's crazy.
But compounding things that come on top of it, like you have an actual tenacity, like which is incredibly rare to actually like run headfirst through that particular brick wall that was in front of you, like trying to build an internet business as a local business. That's a situation that now like the entire world is in, right?
And because of you and your competitors can do it at a speed and turnkey. And then really the way you're doing it, the thing that I've always been really impressed is, I actually want to get to this, and I know we're jumping around, but the speed, I don't know this. You must value speed. How do you value speed? Because I'm floored by the speed and innovation DNA that I'm not like Robbie Deeks or some of the other guys. I don't have fully under the hood. I'm just very good at osmosis, kind of knowing a good amount about everything. It just seems that you guys are so, you launched something yesterday. I have to look, I haven't saw the headline because I knew we were going to meet, but I didn't get to look at it. Like it seems like on the delivery side, it just seems like the apps, the ecosystem you're building to enable somebody who wants to sell honey or a hat, it just feels fast to me.
I mean, it's music to my ears, but it feels like this. From my inside, I never think we actually move fast enough. So
that's the answer. It's probably why you're fast. I always make fun of my team. Everybody thinks we put out so much content that I'm like, we're not even putting out, when people hear me say 100 pieces a day, I'm like, what about 4,000 a day? Like, I don't, that makes sense. But that is clearly, you guys have been able to create a very deep, innovative, fast culture, no?
This is a bigger topic about how this all works, but like the thing that you can also observe, like we launched a pretty big thing yesterday with the shop app, and which is sort of it's sort of a companion app. Like you can track all your packages through it, you can buy from the business you're already buying from, you can discover new local businesses.
It's a logistics parallel for the people that
it tracks the delivery, which is something I think which is amazing, because that right now works through a single email and they click a link and go to USPS and do this, which is kind of crazy, right? So it just ties the entire e-commerce end-to-end cycle together in something like that looks like someone would actually design this from scratch if we would do this right now. But the larger point is when the current COVID crisis that we're in the midst of started, one thing I told the company is that number one is we have to delete all the plans we have.
You made those plans predicated on a very different environment.
Exactly, against a backdrop of fairly like a mutable company on top of a stable economy make plans, but mutable above it doesn't. So the other thing we did is we fairly intentionally said, okay, our minimum quality bar by which we ship is now lower, partly because we need to get things out that are immediately helpful. And one thing I think everyone's realizing, or one lifeline that a lot of local businesses have right now is they either have online stores because their retail stores are not doing anything.
Or they
are starting them really fast, Shopify is playing hopefully a very, very meaningful role at getting like keeping SMBs, small medium businesses, to be
surviving. By the way, back to Vayner Commerce, or a significant role in what I have a lot of passion for, which is Shopify Plus, is enabling the biggest brands in the world to realize they need to start. I mean, you know, this is something I've been yelling about for 10 years at VaynerMedia. It blows me away. Not just Shopify Plus, they have to have an Amazon.com and a Walmart.com strategy in the US, obviously globally other things, but their own DTC capabilities, like the speed in which they can turn. And these big companies are used to buying very heavy, very expensive software. So getting them to understand the value, you know, it's funny, Toby, the other day we lost a pitch in our production company because we were so much less cost than the other two, even though it was the same exact thing. And the client on the other side, they have procurement, you know, this like things like, they're like, we don't trust you. It's not a good price. Mm-hmm. And I've been in meetings where we've debated your Shopify Plus with other of your competitors. And sometimes the clients are put off guard by the value of the price. And I always laugh. I'm like, this is so fucked up. Corporate America is so fucked that when there's something that's a good price, they're just so accustomed to the alternative. I don't know. It's been fascinating to watch.
It's a fascinating dynamic. I think you can put the companies into two buckets on this one. Like the ones which are like this on one side, the ones which like see a good value
binary.
Deal.
I think it's binary. I agree with you.
And the trajectory of those of these two cohorts in the future is going to be very significantly different. So I think this is a problem which sort of solves itself over just market dynamics. But you're exactly right. Like COVID is going on. I think it's going to change a lot of people's opinions on how fast. Like 150-year-old Heinz ketchup didn't go direct in their long history, but within 7 days built a direct-to-consumer site during this crisis. So I think the importance is now that I think the best careers in this industry are going to be will go to the people who are going to lead the direct-to-consumer change of these well-understood larger brands. And the nice thing is, so Shopify is obsessed with entrepreneurship because that's the reason why we exist. But entrepreneurs exist everywhere. Like a lot of entrepreneurs choose to work for a Procter & Gamble and are just entrepreneurial people. And they need the kinds of tools built for entrepreneurs as well to thrive. So I think that's a huge opportunity.
Do you think that that's a person with entrepreneurial tendencies versus an entrepreneur? Like how do you define it for yourself? Like I could go ahead.
No, I agree. I mean it's the people who would like to be who could be entrepreneurs if they made the particular choices to follow this. There's also like a group of people who just actually have no other choice. I would probably count myself in that. And I think you're part of that club too.
Do you think, Toby, that comes with a relationship of fear? Because I think you and I and other, I think entrepreneurs by nature.
I think it's authority problems.
Interesting. But wouldn't that even blend into fear? Not being scared of authority by nature, it's actually your relationship with the fear of things, whether it's authority, whether it's your relationship. Like I like losing. I'm being serious right now. I like when I lose because I like when the crowd boos me. I like the reason Novak Djokovic is my favorite tennis player is because in the biggest matches in the world, whether he's against Nadal or Federer, it's literally 95-5. Mm-hmm. For me, it's not about authority. I actually am empathetic to authority. I actually feel bad for authority. They're usually a boss within a machine. I actually am empathetic to authority. Though I think for you, it might be that I like that. For me, it's actually, I like losing. And in micro, I like the micro loss.
Yeah.
I love it's micro
the, like the fear of, I mean, the thrill of skin in the game, right? Like the fact that there is something like to avoid and something to motivate things forward, right? Like I think entrepreneurship is one of the most pure forms of self-expression. Like every good and successful company is really putting something new into the world one way or another, right? And it almost universally represents in a very accurate way the values of the people who started it. And I think to me, like it's such an institution, it's so important. And it's actually, as you will know, it's actually not a healthy segment, right? Like it's been trending downwards. Like the baby boomers, we have the most entrepreneurial generation post-war, and like Gen X next, and then millennials. we are seeing an uptick now again, and there might be good reasons for why this was the case, like potentially largely around friction. But I think that's something like we need to study entrepreneurship independently of these numbers, because in most countries, like actually in all countries, it's more than 50% of people are employed by small and medium businesses, not by a few mega companies. And that's it's a super important ingredient of the economy of every country. Yet most, like there's a lot of laws that make, that introduce friction into the process of creating business. And so I think that's an underappreciated topic.
All of Europe. I mean, like Europe's relationship with entrepreneurship is a disaster. There might not be a place on earth I love more than Europe, growing up in the wine business, being born in Eastern Europe, just the history. I love history, I love wine. I'm from there. Socially, there's so many things I admire, whether in Sweden or other places. But when I put on my entrepreneurial cap, I don't even think about Europe as a player in any shape, form. I actually think they're a complete afterthought after almost every other continent, sector, place, like Africa, South America, obviously Asia, America, like Europe is done. Because the friction is extraordinary. I don't know, that's how I feel to you.
No, it wasn't a factor in the 90s when I was there, and I'm not sure where it is. It would be sad to find out, but it's still the way it was back then. I at least in Germany.
I hope it's Toby. I don't know. It's worse. No, it's way worse. You know, it's all defense. It's all defense. It's all slow. It's the antithesis of what you're building. I really believe that.
So what's your theory? Because like I think the people with the entrepreneurial impulse are born in all places equally.
I agree.
The top of the funnel is the same.
I agree. Maturity, the maturity of the place. I think it's going to happen to America. I just think it's going to happen in 100 years and I'm not going to see it. I think what ends up happening is the same thing that happens with wealthy children, third generation. There's a very good chance that third and fourth generation kids of the person that started it, that, you know, they're not going to be the same characters. You know, that, you know, adversity creates so much of this. Your grandmother's my hero. I'm not kidding. You know, I come from that part of the world. You know, that post-World War II, Eastern, Western, you know, like that Europe scene, that was gnarly. That was rough. I'm so glad that I had to push through not making this entire thing about your grandmother. To be a woman in that environment, are you fucking kidding? That's a fucking, fuck.
Yeah.
I don't care how many billions, I honestly mean this, I don't care how many billions of dollars our companies are worth at some point. When I look at someone like her, fuck that, man, that's hard as shit.
Most of the real heroes, most of the people who need to be enabled. And you know what, I'm not making commentaries on war here in general, but one thing is like factually true. After World War II, everything had to be rebuilt. Like the concept of that you had to be a builder to affect a positive change was so plainly obvious to absolutely everyone who just spent one like stroll down a street. I think unfortunately we've gotten really removed from it. Andreessen made a good post about this recently, just sort of pointing at hey, almost everything we're building on as like financial derivatives, like a stack further and further down without actually understanding the upper layers. And we really need to fall in love again with the concept of building things. And I think this is why I'm so drawn to the commerce world, because the purity of a transaction is like, hey, this is something humans have been doing for 30,000 years. Like it's like, hey, you've got something I need. Let's make an exchange of value one way or another. Like this is likely the aptitude for language is something that was probably selected for based on the need for trade. So we are thinking about our means of communication as a quintessential human trait. It probably wasn't. And we have a lot of evidence sort of in the records of old villages to see that even though it's like 10,000, 15,000 year old, the rocks and gems that they find are coming from a zone of like 2,000 kilometers around the spot. Like the amount of active trade in early human history is significant. And we are the sort of inheritors, and in fact, so to a smaller degree, the custodians of this part of human history, because we are trying to keep the person, tradesperson, maker, builder to audience relationship alive in a direct way without going through this like distraction that existed for the last 100 years of a sort of department store disembodiment of makers.
Listen, Toby, I think now I'm listening to you and I'm like, oh, we have another trait, which is, I don't know if you recall this part of school, but literally the only class that I was good at was history. And I'm listening to you and you're clearly attracted to history or spend time on it. Is that because I think what you're saying makes so much sense to me. It was the biggest reason that I believed in the internet. We, you know, when it became real in my head in the mid 90s, I'm like, this makes so much sense. This last 50 year at the time, 55, and I really quantified things post World War II. I was like, these last 55 years have been the rise of consolidation, the supermarket. Like people don't even think, they're like, it used to be a market. And then somebody went to the suburb because of the highway infrastructure, supermarket.
Yeah, I made it super and on the go.
Scale, 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 kill Main Street, kill Main Street, kill the small towns, kill the cities, suburb, big. Well, I don't think people understand every pendulum swings. If you love history, like I think you might, and I do, like it just swings. So inevitably the internet was going to build, and you've built marvelously on top of it, the rise of the micro. I mean, literally every single person in the chat right now, half of which are yelling at me for cutting you off, which I think I'm doing a pretty damn good job. This is usually I'm way worse. I respect you so much and I want to hear your thoughts, but you know, like, and mainly it's because I hear the thing and I get into it. So I apologize, limited time, you know how that is. But you know, the reality is that every person that's watching right now, and obviously the ones that are going to listen to the podcast and over the next 3 years, it scares me out of excitement that they can use a couple of tools and be in the game. That's crazy. You know how much capital you needed for a storefront? It's nuts. It's incredible. Thoughts?
Yeah, I know. I actually like your framing about the you know, the market became super, but like, what about is actually super afterwards? You know, like
it was super just intense. Size.
Yeah, one single superintendent to own the entire market, which is like the antithesis of the market. We wanted the bazaar, not the cathedral, right? And so I think the internet, like I remember, like this is some, like everyone's gonna laugh, but I remember when the internet came to town, right? Like that was actually an event. Like the local university got lit up. And we actually had to steal a key to the computer room because I never got went to university to get there. And all my early memories are like the incredible participatory power of internet, like chat rooms where you could say something and everyone like communicate. And remember, against the night, like this is the early 90s. As a kid in a small town, like what was there for me to do something? Like there was no equivalent. Like I could call in a game show. That was a, like if it put me on broadcast, that was the one way I could do something akin to anything I could do on the internet. So the difference to from before to after was so much. And so this distributed promise of the early internet, which I think everyone anticipated, is still like it fires me up so much. I want to keep that, and I don't think this is how it went, right? Like we have one search engine, and we have probably one social network, really. And
for now, you know this. To me, look what's happening. I apologize for interrupting before I get punched in the face. Look what's going on with if you look at what's happening with StockX and eBay. StockX in the last half decade has been able to chip away. I remember you, and you remember this, Toby, like the rise of social networks. There was like 8,000 of them. There was a sports social network. There was Dogster by, you know, a great guy who unfortunately passed away. Like there was incredible sites being built micro, but then it consolidated, much like the supermarket. I will be on the ground stunned if in 2 decades, 3 decades, 4 decades, I don't have the timing, but eBay will have 7 significant sector competitors. StockX has gone after, you know, kind of a, you know, sneakers, collectibles kind of angle, but somebody's going to launch an antiques version. And by the way, it's how I see Spotify and Amazon. I see Amazon as the kind of like the main thing. And Bezos is literally one of the most incredible entrepreneurs to ever exist in the way he executed and timing. And I really do look at Spotify as the scalable micro. I think that's why you've been successful. It's why I leaned in so much. It's why I bought so much of your stock on your IPO. You know, like I really genuinely believe. I said, this is the counter chess move to the rise of Amazon. And I think you'll see that with social networks in perpetuity. I think TikTok's another example that will show this is never gonna be stagnant. And I think there's good news. What you want to happen, when I heard you deliver that sentence, that is inevitably gonna happen because it's called the human spirit.
Totally agreed. Yeah, no, Spotify is a wonderful company. I hope you bought some Shopify stock too when doing IPO.
Oh, did I say, you know what's so funny? Did I say Spotify? I apologize. You know, no, you know, I bought both, by the way. So I've done quite well. But I bought a lot more of Shopify and your company because I'm a merchant, I'm a retailer, but more importantly, the reason I bring it up is because of the macro thesis. Like it was so obvious what Amazon was becoming at the time that you were growing. And it was so obvious that at some point, I didn't know if you were capable of being the operator to build it, but the micro thesis was inevitable. It's human spirit.
First of all, I think the jury's still out if I'm the operator to build it. It's also not exactly my goal. I really don't think Shopify is in a existential fight with Amazon.
I don't think they're even in the same universe.
I don't think this sort of zero sum thinking about this or that is useful because it's about building things and being of value, right? And I think you need Amazon as a major channel. I have nothing against the default place.
Sure.
I would like to but I agree sort of with this vision of the internet as this participatory distributed enablement for everyone environment. And I think unless someone is building like this pendulum you're talking about, it's true, but it's not based on just sort of time moving forward. It's based on the different realities at different points of time, and these realities shift significantly based on the infrastructure that's being built. So like something like Shopify needs to exist to make it friction free to build to start a new business and hopefully scale it into the hundreds of millions of dollars or beyond. If that doesn't exist, and that's something that you have to hire, like you have to start with two developers who hopefully are affordable at the moment, and then you have to scale it from there, then just even though there's lots of entrepreneurs who could do it, it's going to be diminished in terms of numbers as opposed to if it's friction-free. So I think friction ends up being such a major component in this, and it's super important. Like but every space has someone's trying to aggregate it all together, and someone else should be there to distribute it so that there's an opportunity on both sides.
I think that's right. I actually think, to your point, and I couldn't agree more, I think when you layer this conversation on the understanding about how much abundance there is, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, to me, I think so many people get caught up in the zero-sum game. And to your point, even in a world, if Amazon and Shopify continue to be players on the consolidation and the expansion of, even within that, there's an ungodly amount of crevices. You know, there's 4 to 7 to 15 micro, segmentation cohorts, availabilities to build significant change, innovation, along in parallel to things that might be on the opposite spectrum of in the macro of consolidation and expansion.
And so how do you think about opportunity right now? Like this is like special times right now. I feel like at least for e-commerce, 2030 just got pulled forward to 2020. So
right.
How does that, how would you describe, what do you tell people who want to go in retail now?
I think you're right. I think I think what you and I are doing right now, video conferencing and retail, travel and retail, office building, hotels, conferences, and retail. These are the by far biggest things impacted in a post-COVID world. Not all in the same direction, And so how do I think about it? I think that there'll be interesting innovations. I'll give you an example. you know, I've noticed that people are picking up at department stores items. And I think that the Targets, Tesco's, Walmart's, Costco's, and on are actually going to stumble into something they needed to build as an actual competitive advantage or offset against something like Amazon. So A, the incumbents that I think were on their way to really difficult times might have been forced, back to what we talked about, into innovation that might actually help them against some of the emerging threats. Two, I think that the behavior shifts are forever. You know, you can't, you know, you can't, I always say, when you see something great, you can never unsee it. And I think there's a 63-year-old in every single town and every single street in America, and not even 63-year-old, you have plenty 25-year-olds who get into their own habits, who've purchased something on the internet, whether it's a bar of soap, whether it's a banana, whether it's a television, that they would have never, or to your point, would have made that first purchase in 2030, that they've tasted it now. And when they go back to real life, it doesn't even comprehend to them why they would go back to it, because they've realized they've saved time, which is something we always subconsciously lean towards. So how do I think about it? It's, I think that you and your contemporaries, your competitors, and many other great people are building incredible tools. Let's use retail. I think that you, your company, and your competitors, and many of them are doing solid jobs as well, are building the incredible ability to have a store. I have always had an incredible knack of how to get customers to come to the store. And more importantly, and why we launched Vayner Commerce, sustainable e-commerce. I mean, you must be bored of CAC and LTV math. With it's such a one-dimensional conversation in e-commerce that has dominated the last half decade, when there are 30 other variables that actually matter. For me, I'm spending all my time, especially with the audience that's listening now, how do I educate and bring value for them to understand, A, how to most cost-effectively bring the right kind of people to their quote-unquote store, and then how do they keep them? And then, honestly, Toby, I'm trying to make sure they believe in and make a good product. Because when you're a good marketer, the thing you figure out very quickly is if you're great at your job, but you're marketing a shit product, you're just going to speed up them going out of business. So that's how I'm thinking about it. How about you?
Yeah, I think that's right. I always emphasize, like, LTV is a better metric than, I mean, it's a, you need customers to be able to measure it, of course. But like LTV thinking, I think, leads you to making better product. And I think that's like, you want to start a relationship. And I, you know, the internet is really, really, really good at this now, even doing this at a distance. We constantly get new categories of products that work really, really well over the internet. Like things like sometimes technology really helps. Like we see a lot of furniture stores do extremely well, especially the ones who sell the kinds of things that you need for a home office right now. And the ones which do extremely well are the ones who are early adopters of you know, some of those tools we ship around augmented reality, like where you can literally take the desk you're looking at and place it through your phone in the room just to see how does this fit. And so, like, this is, first of all, it's a really cool trick. It's cool to see. It's cool to experience it. You start trusting the brand because this cool experience. But then also, and this is, I think, more significant, the experience of doing that and seeing how this product fits precisely into your house and what it looks like, and you can walk around it, is actually vastly superior to what going to a retail location and seeing this product in person, because it's way more in context. Like, no retail location can hope to match your actual house in terms of context. And I think we are seeing these kind of ideas, sometimes technology, sometimes just communication, sometimes just approach, and often through video, just everywhere. And people are stopping to talk about what they are selling and starting to talk about why they are selling this, or why this product needs to exist, and why why they have a burning desire to upend their own lives to create the company to make that thing, right? Which is way more interesting than that thing in most cases. And so I think that's really, really important in terms of, again, the crisis. Again, I think e-commerce, it has bet in the future. I agree with you. We are never going to go back to the way it was. It'll e-commerce will be a larger share of a retail industry. I think more importantly, you said this earlier, like every business needs to be in every channel. Like you have to be on, you know, eBay and on Facebook and Instagram and on your website and through email and whatnot. That makes sense, but it's the core of that, of how to get there, is that every business is now a digital business. Like you need a like somewhere in the cloud, you need a factual information about the products you have, the assets related to them, the inventory levels, and where you have them. And then from there, you're gonna post the products into channels to sell. You create your retail store is connected to that rather than the other way around. There's no, like, this entire idea of like syncing stuff around is crazy. Nice. And so I think everyone has just gotten like has been part of a school of hard knocks in terms of the physical retail world, and I've realized that their physical retail store is a is sort of a mini business connected to the global world of commerce by the very tenuous strand of a single street, and that street can go away because suddenly everyone is under in a lockdown. And that's no, like, the businesses that have prepared for this or had adopted very digital solutions to all these problems I just talked about, many of them are doing well. I some of them are actually thriving because their products fit so perfectly into this new world. But many of them are doing much better than people would imagine. It's just that the retail sales have gone down a lot. So lots of them have shifted to open commerce.
And it's constant innovation. When I told my dad that winelibrary.com was our actual store and our store was secondary in 1998, literally he got upset with me, literally emotionally upset, because he thought, it's played out 25 years later. People have all their capital expenses into their leases, into their things, but the consumer doesn't care. And innovation will continue to matter. I launched this text wine thing for my dad. Had we not launched that a year ago, that is the driver to why my dad's wine business right now is doing as well as if it had been open. Plus people want to drink during COVID. But you know, like, I mean, the reality is that the innovation doesn't have to stop even when you're on e-commerce. I think what I'm excited about, you know, you think about text commerce, you think about virtual reality and how that plays out, you know, how advanced the world will be. You know, you and I have experienced through our lives the last 25 years of innovation. We've gone from dial-up internet and a modem and it taking an hour to download a, you know, Cindy Crawford picture on your computer to where we are today, right? Like, the next 25 years are gonna be bananas. I mean, you know, when you start thinking about all the innovation that's coming. And so, yeah, I'm with you. I think it's a very, very interesting time. Toby, I wanna bring a little value to the audience. There's a lot of aspiring entrepreneurs, especially in commerce. Anything that you can make extremely practical going into the trenches, anything you see emerging as a trend, a common theme of success in e-commerce, any tidbits of wisdom or observations that you've seen?
I don't have anything super like top of mind, like, other than motherhood statements, right? Like it's would be the most adaptable business of ones which are thriving. I think one question everyone has to ask themselves is this, like, the product I'm selling, does that fit better into the world of 2010 or better into a world of 2030? You don't have to really predict what 2030 is like, although that's a really good practice if you do that, to be able to do this. This is just following a trend line. And if the answer is like yes, just go all in, because the next years, like, we're speeding to that now, especially with COVID. Like, again, all inevitable change is now happening sooner than otherwise would have, because the entire world has a functioning understanding of, like, working with the rest of their companies through digital means. Like, there's not an executive in the world who now is like, oh, someone print my emails and once a day. Like, that, I mean, maybe, but like, they are gonna be not.
I know one. But
you talk to him recently?
He's an investor and he's super old school and he's not, and he needs to, it's insane. But nonetheless, I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah, I'm sure even he is now on his all partner meetings that they could just walk to before on a Zoom call, and that will change the world in just from the functioning it understanding has. Of this.
Have you had a different, like, do you feel post this your travel, your meetings, your work from home balances are going to be in a totally different direction?
I mean, we are blessed as a technology company for always having had a remote setup. We started, like, Ottawa, where our headquarters is a million people city, which is sizable, but not as big as many of our primary places where people start startups. So we had like 5 offices fairly quickly, and in a lot of ways, we as a company have trained for this and had really, really good setups and no VPNs and all these kind of things. So one thing it did tell us is like the general quality of collaboration through remote work is just so much better than it was even 5 years ago. And then again, in a couple of years, it's going to be so much better yet. So we'll probably do even more of that. I don't think it's worthwhile to speculate right now, but like I think a lot of people who work at Shopify will choose to say, okay, well, I'm gonna work more remotely or exclusively remotely, and I think everyone should be ready for that. There'll also be a large percentage of people who say I'll never work remotely again based on their experience, and that depends a little bit on, you know,
family,
how
their relationships, kids, the health of their relationship, and many other things. I agree. Do you have anything anything we didn't touch on as we wrap up here?
I mean, we touched on a great many topics. I hope, again, like I started Shopify because it's the software that I hoped to find in 2004. It has then in 2008 lived through one recession, which was of course very different from a current one. The great thing for Shopify was that back then, people needed new jobs because they lost their jobs, or they needed to go from extremely expensive e-commerce packages that they might have had to something a little bit more affordable. So all those trends were good for Shopify, and we ended up doing reasonably well throughout the recession. So that was an interesting experience. And I would like just to point out to people that I'm sure this is not news to anyone in your audience specifically, but this is a time of opportunity. Like, a lot of the best companies are either formed during recessions and tough times, or get sort of their sea legs under during the first crisis. And it's gonna go. It's hard, and it's important to have like communities to sort of share the burden. Work as hard as is comfortable. Don't kill yourself because it's a marathon, no sprint. That's just,
I love it.
If you want to win, it's important thing is not to die. optimize for that.
I think that's right. Brother, let me wrap up with this, because I think people need to hear it. In the e-com circles, people see these enormously well-funded Series C, Series D, you know, New York, LA based companies, and they're the ones that take up 90% of the oxygen of the headlines. There are not a lot of people on earth that have a better view of how many wildly successful, back to not getting burnt out, incredibly happy people are running $500,000 a year with $300,000 in profit, which pays for their incredible lifestyle, 1.9 million in top line revenue with, again, $500,000 in profit that pays for a very nice lifestyle, selling something they grew up making with their grandmother. As a parting shot, because I think this is the most important, please just give an indication or a statement or a confirmation to how long the long tail is of very practical, very sound, very well-structured, not VC-backed in perpetuity, not build, you know, people that are actually building businesses, small businesses in e-commerce, selling something that they discovered on a trip, or they went on a resourcing trip to China, or they're making it in their backyard or in their living room. Give people like the truth, because I think people see the mattress companies or the, you know, the clothing brands that are these crazy valuations that, you know, raise so much money, influencer marketing to the zoo, Instagram, Facebook, and they don't think it's practical, yet there's so much happiness and practicality in the e-commerce sector today that gets no pub. True?
Yeah. Your intuition is totally correct. on this. I talk to a lot of wonderful founders. So this is my favorite part of the gig here, and it's the VC thing. Like, I mean, I did it. I did the fundraising. I built a venture-backed company, but it's I did it after building a profitable business first. I only took VC 6 years into the whole thing. I think VC is fascinating. It's powerful. It's incredibly important for a planet because it does sometimes back the moonshots, which otherwise wouldn't happen. But it's an overused thing. It's a tool in the toolbox that should come out if you have a particular problem that it solves, which is that you have a fund limited growth business with an existing growth engine that needs fueling, where no one else gives you the money because no one else looks at the kind of metrics that VCs fund on. And if that's not your situation, like I would suggest not to go that way. And I like when you bring up some numbers, those are all valid numbers, but I've seen significantly larger numbers sometimes.
I know you have.
And some people who are completely uninterested in getting these numbers, because honestly, like the people who tend to build the best businesses are the people who don't go into them because they're trying to make money. They're trying to get into them because they either have a burning desire to share something or a intellectual curiosity to challenge themselves and figure out, if I would create this thing, what would happen? Like, those are the mindsets which I think lead to incredibly good businesses.
Read in a
path that actually the entrepreneurs never actually went down.
I think curiosity and scratching one's curiosity and the frustration of not finding the thing you personally need, those have historically been the things I've done best at as an investor. Those are the things that I've admired the most from afar. And to your point, you know, I'm using those numbers because I'm trying to get people to understand the happiness can come in a lot of forms. It's much more practical. People, I know that I know Shopify founders, you know, e-commerce founders who are doing 41 million, you know, and kicking real, like the numbers get up there, but, you know, I think that I just think about the person who's super curious or super great at baking bread or making necklaces, who genuinely doesn't like their job. It's one thing if you love your job, but genuinely don't. If they just understood that they could practically, you know, because you know what happened, Toby, and you know this, everything is about now building billion-dollar companies or 40 million, you know. I just am saying to myself, there's somebody making $113,000 as a mid-level executive or $42,000 at a job they genuinely dislike, and I can't believe how touchable, how real it is for them to replicate that salary with their dividends from a business selling t-shirts that they love or eyeglasses or coconuts. I mean, it's very exciting. I don't know what else to say.
Absolutely. And I think even more important, behind those people stand, like, Shopify has about a million merchants on it. It's hard to get the amount of people employed by all this business, but it's in the millions as well. Like they don't make $130,000. They make 30, 40, 50. Like, I think the average household income, which sometimes is two earners in the United States, is something about 45, I think, thousand a year. So there's a lot of big numbers being thrown around, but it's incredibly important to create employment for more people, to, like, create opportunity. Like, by you following your curiosity, building a business, you may actually provide livelihood to 10, 20 other people, and not just direct, also indirect down the supply chain. And then people buy from you. And because people buy from you, they're voting for your product. And because people vote for your product, you're going to sustain this product and you're going to create employment and you're going to create. And this is the circle which is kicked off by these businesses. And I think this is off. It's massively overlooked as a force for change in the world, and it's been the change. Yes,
it's been the change. Thank you for enabling it in your big/little way, Toby, and thank you for being on.
Thank you very much for having me. Good to catch up.
It's always good. It's good. It's been way too long. Let's not have this big of a gap next time.
Good.
All right. Bye bye. Thanks everybody for watching. We really appreciate you listening. I hope you got value. We'll talk to you soon. Thank you guys. Bye bye. as we end today's podcast, I want to give a huge shout out to the people. You know, it's so funny. People that leave reviews and written reviews of this podcast on Apple, Spotify, and all the other platforms just mean the world to me. You've taken an extra 13 to 95 seconds to show love and also give context to people of why this is a worthwhile podcast. So I appreciate that so much. And even more fun, because I think we all love a little cosign or a shout out or a little awareness, I'm going to have the team give a couple of shout outs daily on our favorite reviews. So take it away. Which were our favorites this week?
Thanks, Gary. Today's highlighted review is Positive Brainwaves by B. Birch. No podcast is going to have 100% pertinent content to any listener. I'd recommend Gary V because in my experience, after listening the hour after hour, I'm inspired. I'm feeling positive and I'm moving in the direction I feel is important. I hope it does the same for you. Thanks to B. Birch. Keep those reviews coming. We could highlight yours next.